Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
That we live in an era roiled by concerns about how democratic, supposedly democratic countries actually are, and when skepticism abounds about how truly representative our electoral systems are, a scholarly study of debates on many of these issues among leading theorists of democracy in Victorian Britain is just the ticket. This is what is on offer in the 2019 book by Gregory Conti, Parliament, the Mirror of the Nation, Representation, Deliberation, and Democracy in Victorian Britain. Conti employs tools of the fields of political theory and political and intellectual history to render vivid and touching the fierce debates among such well-known figures as John Stuart Mill and Walter Bagehot, as well as in-between figures such as Thomas Hare, 1806 to 1891. Fierce in terms of the sometimes cruel lampooning of their respective opponents, and touching in that many of the proponents of these proposed reforms, such as proportional representation and the single transferable vote, were convinced that their nostrums would usher in a golden age for Britain's parliament and thereby the nation. Note, though, that for many of the figures in this book, it was the proper workings of parliament and its capacity for reasoned deliberation that they cared about, not so much democratic processes per se in terms of how representatives got elected to it. Indeed, much of what was advocated was designed to keep certain groups out of parliament and government generally. For many of the thinkers discussed in this book, parliament in its member makeup should mirror the composition of the nation at large. This was particularly true of adherents of the variety of suffrages theory, who pined for the hodgepodge of electoral constituencies, especially those in the countryside that were controlled by aristocrats and which were derisively referred to as rotten boroughs or pocket boroughs, that prevailed before passage of the Reform Act of 1832. Bagehot was of this school. Others, like Mill and Hare, were enamored of the rather complex system of proportional representation, believing that it would militate against what they saw as the evil of too much power devolving to political parties, which they feared would be dominated by intellectually inferior plebeians. The word swamped was often used. Finally, there were straight-up Democrats, such as the future leader of the Labour Party and future Prime Minister Ramsay MacDonald, who opposed proportional representation as fundamentally elitist and a hindrance to robust debate and effective government. Conti's book is a fascinating exploration of a relatively neglected period in the history of discourse on what democracies need to thrive, who should be allowed to vote, how voting should be done, and whether votes mattered so much as seats in parliament. There were even arguments if some people did not get to vote, but their interests were represented, that was good enough. Let's hear from Professor Conti himself about this lively period of democracy talk. Hello, everyone. My name is Hope J. Lehman, and I'm one of the hosts of the New Books Network. I'm talking today with Gregory Conti, author of the 2019 book, Parliament, the Mirror of the Nation, Representation, Deliberation, and Democracy in Victorian Britain. Thank you for joining us today, Greg.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Well, that's good. I think this book, I would have thought, what could Victorian, rather arcane debates about Victorian democracy have to say to us? But it's a very useful background to how modern democratic systems came to be. So I'd like to talk about the background of your book in terms of how it came to be published. Your book is part of a series from Cambridge University Press called Ideas in Context. And I'd like to ask you about that series and how your book came to be one of the entries in it, and why your book is such a useful combination of political theory and fairly straightforward history.
Great. Well, let me reiterate my thanks for asking me to come on here and say how much I appreciate the attention with what you went through. What's a pretty dense and and heavy book full of sort of arcane technical details and unfamiliar authors and so on. But to answer your question, which is a good one and kind of has a few different parts to it already. As for ideas in context specifically, that's probably the most esteemed series in the field of the history of political thought. It's been around for decades now. It was the brainchild of Quentin Skinner and other luminaries associated with what was called the Cambridge School or contextualist approach to the study of political theory. That is basically the idea that to understand even authors who we might regard as articulating kind of perennial or transcendental principles like Hobbes or Plato, One still needs to understand the debates and movements in which they were enmeshed at the time. So, you know, that's kind of the calling card of the series. I'll mention that alongside this series, those same, more or less the same people founded another series at Cambridge, which is called The Cambridge Texts in the History of Political Thought, or as it's often known, the Blue Series, because all the volumes have blue covers. And that series brings out modern editions of these sort of older texts with scholarly introductions and notes and so forth to make them accessible. And I slip in a mention of that sort of for selfish reasons, because we actually have a book coming out in that series in February. So anyone who liked this book could go and pursue that. It's a book that will collect and analyze in depth some of the writings of one of the figures who's kind of featured in this book. That's the constitutional lawyer, Albert Van Dicey.
Oh, wonderful. I'm glad to hear that, because he was a really fascinating figure in the book. And I was really learned a lot about him from your book. And I'm so glad that you'll deal with him at length in another book.
Yeah, thanks. He is a very interesting figure. This book sort of mostly focuses on his sort of youth insofar as he enters into it. But
and he was on the scene a long, many decades, wasn't he?
He lived a very long life, yes. Mm. And this upcoming thing is kind of a collection of writings of his from later than this book covers. How did my book come to be in the series? Well, there's nothing particularly exalted about the process, I guess. I sent them the manuscript and they accepted it. and I was very happy to publish it with them, kind of for the reasons I said above about its sort of place within the field. I did have some thoughts. I don't know how much you want to go into this about you asked about kind of the combination of political.
Yes, I'd be interested in that because you do discuss that in the book and it's very interesting. So
Yeah. So I mean, as for whether my book is a kind of successful combination of the two.
Two being history and political theory.
Then. Yeah. Well, it's not really for me to say, I suspect, but I'll take your word for it that it is. I do think that there is kind of a, you know, on the general point, though, about why it is that political theorists and philosophers should pay attention to history, I do think there are some things to be said. And then it's useful to keep these in view. And I would just say that, and this also gets to some of the aspirations of the book, I think, if we bear these in mind. So I think there are really two reasons why you want philosophers and political theorists to know something about history and to pay close attention to it. And the first, I think, is just that history helps to focus one's mind on concrete questions and not get caught up in some of the abstraction that's inherent in a lot of philosophizing. So I think, you know, in public discourse and political philosophy, it's quite difficult not to just take for granted an overwhelming number of assumptions, such as the institutional backdrop that happens to exist at any given time. And there's kind of a tendency to naturalize whatever features we see of the political world around us, to imagine they're much more permanent than they are. And so I think, you know, to kind of historicize political thought is a way of avoiding being complacent about the sort of institutional setup you see in front of you. And it also, I think, history forces you to confront concrete institutional forms in light of which past thinkers might have articulated values that now we readily assume kind of have only a certain valence to them. So, you know, we might assume that equality mandates X, Y, or Z because that's how we're used to talking about it in the time. And what historical inquiry provides, I think, is a sense of mismatch. You know, so you can look back and you can find institutions unlike those with which we're familiar being justified in the name of values or ends which resonate with us, or vice versa. You can kind of find institutions similar or identical to our own being defended on grounds that are not widely known or accepted today. So I think for that reason, history is kind of, you know, it can play a mediating role for political philosophers between sort of the concrete and the institutional and the particular and sort of normative or the realm of very high values. And I also think another reason why it's good to pay close attention to history is maybe more, you know, this is maybe more ontological. It's kind of something about the character of our political ideas. And that's just that all of our major concepts and ideas were themselves shaped historically. And so if you have no reference to that history, you're almost certain to just wind up presenting as great innovations, you know, great innovations that came from one's own mind, what are in truth sort of longstanding and intractable problems and dilemmas. So, you know, I think it's just not true, for example, that one could derive the meaning of liberalism or socialism simply abstractly without reference to the development of ideas over time, especially because things like liberalism, socialism, democracy, et cetera, are traditions that were built up by intellectuals and political actors. And as such, you know, I think they partake of certain observable patterns and structures that persist even as change occurs. So I think to claim to elaborate a liberal or socialist political philosophy without some real knowledge of the genesis and evolution of these categories is kind of, you know, misleading and mystifying. And I think I'll just, you know, I'll just leave it there on the general question of why it's useful to attend to history for people who are interested in political philosophy. But, you know, I'm not, just the last thing to say, I guess, is I'm not a methodological fundamentalist in any way. I don't think that, you know, my book is kind of, you know, monopolizes the template for how to write a good book. There are plenty of extremely good books in political philosophy that are much less historical than my own. But those are some of the reasons why I'm attracted to history.
I think one thing that was very interesting about your book is you do revisit figures such as Mill. I'll mention that in just a moment, but you do use history very effectively to illustrate the ideas that were being discussed. So all of these people are discussing, well, in a very elevated fashion among a very elite circle, but then you have the statistic in your book that from about a third of adult men in Britain from 1885 to 1918 still lacked the franchise. So while primarily men were discussing this, you point out that a huge proportion of the British population, let alone women, were not able to vote. And that's why it's so fascinating to have your analysis of connecting the fact that they were discussing things that affected real people. But one of the things that I think is effective in that is that these real people were affected by the fact that, for example, the John Stuart Mills, you make the point that his ideas, and he's regarded as this great liberal, this voice of reason and so forth, many of his ideas, as particularly on proportional representation, were fundamentally anti-democratic. At least that's what many of his critics said. Could you address Mill's views of, and also why he leaped to, well, actually, could you tell us about Thomas Hare and why John Stuart Mill just pounced on his ideas and why he promoted them so strongly?
So Thomas Hare, you're right to kind of focus on him. He is one of the central players in the book. I think when I was looking back at it to refresh for this interview, I think he is actually the most cited person in the book. And what's important about him for this work is that he was the person who developed the notion of proportional representation that became central to Victorian England. He conceived of the scheme that's called, still to this day, called the single transferable vote, which was adopted, as you say, by John Stuart Mill, the most famous philosopher of the time, and treated as one of the great discoveries in the realm of representative government to that point in history by Mill. I think he said basically that, you know, that Hare's innovation had solved all of the extant dilemmas about representative government. So pretty high praise. And Hare's an interesting figure. I mean, he was in some ways very emblematic of the social and intellectual world of Victorian liberalism. He was of Mill's generation, which is to say he was born in the first decade of the 19th century. He was a prolific author, writing on a number of subjects, but he also, again, like Mill, who worked in the East India Company for his whole life, and like a lot of the great Victorian authors, Matthew Arnold and so forth, he was not just a prolific author, but also had a notable professional career. And in his day job, he was a barrister and then an inspector of charities. Also some of his dearest causes, like support of industrial cooperatives, which Mill also fastened on, were very fashionable among the educated liberal set of his day. So anyway, he came into Mill's life and into broader public prominence in the late 1850s when he laid out in elaborate detail a scheme of the single transferable vote for one single national constituency. That's another very odd feature of Hare's theory, that there would be no local constituencies whatsoever in the English electoral system anymore. Anyway, and he called that package of items personal representation. You had other, what exactly did you want me to get into about Hare?
Go ahead.
No, did you want me to
For example, in the single transferable vote, that was the basis of Hare's ideas, or one of them.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah.
So could you explain about how that would wipe out? You talk about in the book, it would wipe out local constituencies. So wouldn't that lead to just utter domination by London of the rest of the entire country?
No, London would, whatever proportion of the population London represented, London would have the possibility of electing that many members to Parliament. There's an interesting aspect. So as you say, Hare's system, I think for our purposes, can be said to be based on two things. One is the single transferable vote, which that's a mechanism for how to allocate people's votes. And the second is the question of the scope of constituencies. And you could have combined these differently. So indeed, Ireland to this day has the single transferable vote, but they also have a number of local constituencies. They just use the single transferable vote within those. So what Hare proposed to do basically to have an elaborate system of quotas and to allow voters to rank order their preferred candidates. What would happen is the single transferable vote is quite a technical subject, but basically the idea is to have a quota of votes. The quota here meaning how many votes you need to get in order to be returned to Parliament. And that quota is established by dividing the number of members that you're going to have in Parliament. So at that time, 658, by the overall number of voters who will cast a ballot. And any candidate who attains that number is elected from wherever in the country their votes come. And then as soon as they reach the quota, any surplus votes that they get are transferred to other candidates who those voters had listed lower on their ballot. And then you kind of eliminate other candidates sequentially, and their votes are also transferred to other candidates. And you just eliminate from the slate of candidates, whoever's at the bottom, and transfer their votes until you fill up the number of members needed for Parliament. So it's quite a complicated system, but basically, from the perspective of the voter, you have the right to list as many names as you want in order. And let's say that my first vote goes to somebody who receives way more votes than he needs. Well, then that my vote would be transferred to whoever's next on my list. And let's say that person receives way fewer votes than they would need to get elected. Well, then my vote for the second person is translated to whoever's third on my list, and so on, until your vote arrives as part of an effective quota for somebody who's actually getting elected to Parliament. So it's a complicated, very complicated system, as you point out. And I think that did, in fact, impede its acceptance. But that's somewhat separate from the question of the size of the constituency. So one thing you could do is just have a constituency where, say, you know, just within this town, we're going to elect three members to Parliament, and we're going to decide who those three members are by the single transferable vote. That's one thing you can do. And that's much less sort of elaborate. You don't have people potentially listing, you know, hundreds of names on their ballot. But Hare was unsatisfied with that. And Hare wanted to do away with local territorial districting in its entirety and have a single national constituency. In Israel, they actually have a single national constituency, though they don't use the single transferable vote. They use a party list system. So, you know, for Hare, what would happen is that candidates could still, if they wished for, symbolically list themselves as standing from a given locality. But voters would not be bound to vote for candidates from their own district. They could simply vote for whomever they wished from throughout the nation. And for Hare, this provision was intended to liberate electors from the happenstance constraints of locality so that they might combine with other citizens of similar opinions to return the candidate they judged most fit and to combine with other citizens, like-minded citizens, wherever they might be in, you know, across the United Kingdom. So for Hare, this was really a matter of individual emancipation, liberating voters from the kind of narrow constraints of local constituencies, which he thought inhibited their ability but to engage in voluntary and natural forms of association. So, you know, it's a quite elaborate scheme. If you're interested, I think it's much easier to get a grip on it by actually reading it than by hearing someone try to talk about it, because it is, you know, electoral systems are complicated and it's easier to see them sort of diagrammed on the page.
I was just going to say, speaking of reading it, you have this very funny line in your book about how difficult Hare was to read, because you say, in consequence of the almost unreproachable manner in which the book was composed, there developed a subgenre within Victorian political literature, the clarification of Hare pamphlet, which I thought was a hilarious line, because it made clear that these were very, and someone like Ramsay MacDonald later in your book, he just completely dismisses the idea, and he just says this is too complicated. It actually impairs representative democracy, and it was fascinating how impatient others got with it, and rightly so, I think. But I interrupted you. I'm sorry.
No. Well, I think that's true. I think there are versions of the single transferable vote that are more workable. In practice, the single transferable vote probably works best in situations where you do have a set of geographically arranged constituencies and you're going to elect multiple members from them. So say something like 3 to 5 members. And then what the single transferable vote allows to happen there is that, say, I don't know, 20 people could run. And parties wouldn't face this problem where they have to winnow down to just a few candidates in order to avoid having their vote be split in ways that harm them, because people can rank order the candidates they wish. So, you know, so there's no worry that, say, you know, if just to use American party labels, that Republicans would run too many candidates and therefore the vote would be split too many ways and only Democrats would get in from the constituency. So, you know, you can imagine that working and in a sense, allowing voters a little more free choice, loosening up the ability of parties to constrain who can effectively stand for office. You can imagine that working in smaller, more manageable constituencies. And indeed, actually, in Cambridge, Massachusetts, they still use the single transferable vote. At my university, Princeton, they use the single transferable vote for faculty, various faculty committees. And you can imagine it working in those contexts. But yeah, in terms of an entire nation, liberated from any kind of geographical boundaries, it becomes quite implausible that people are, say, going to be able to list, you know, 45 names intelligently. I think Hare's scheme rightly kind of came to grief on those grounds. As for its complicatedness, I mean, it's true that it's a very complex book. And it's true that in his own way, Hare was a kind of utopian and a dreamer. On the other hand, you know, I don't think that's a reason not to pay attention to it. You know, it is quite funny that, as you know, you were right to pick up on that passage. It is funny that he could have thought that this very complex, very involved tract that he had written was going to play a decisive role in shaping actual party politics. And so in Hare there, you do sort of see a recurring pathology, you might say, amongst intellectuals and politics who just are unable to calibrate their ideas, you know, at the right level for public consumption. On the other hand, though, I do think that you can see in Hare's work kind of, it's interesting to see how major concepts like, you know, representative government, like the freedom of the elector, It's curious to see how they're deployed in relation to other values and in relation to a concrete, you know, instance of reform. And so I think for that reason, Hare's election of representatives is well worth reading. You know, for instance, I think it's quite telling that Hare, you know, in selling his electoral system, he tries to set it within a broad historical trajectory of increasing individual liberty. So, you know, he sees kind of the sweep of politics, especially, you know, post-revolutionary France. You know, he sees the scope of modern politics after the French Revolution and after the Reform Act in England as one where the arc of history is bending towards greater individual choice. And he thinks one area, though, where we don't, in fact, see the system living up to those values or don't see reform concretely guided by the prospect of emancipating the individual is in the electoral system. And he believed that his was a project for bringing that kind of liberty, which so many kind of view as a hallmark of classical liberalism. Well, he saw himself importing that into elections. Similarly, you know, he makes a lot of analogies between his system of personal or proportional representation and the principles of free trade in the economic realm, which were really cherished by liberals of the day. So it's an interesting book in the sense that it combines a kind of wild impracticality about a particular aspect, right? The fact that, and really though only one particular aspect, I mean, he believed that you could have the single transferable vote in a single national constituency in order to generate a parliament of 658 members. That was wrong. But in a sense, if he had been a little bit more flexible about that and had been able to see the single transferable vote as something that allowed you to loosen, say, geographical restrictions, have constituencies of 5 to 10 members or something, and to replicate that across the country, it's very possible that he would have struck a chord that resonated with, you know, that resonated with people in the country. And certainly a lot of people took up his mantle afterwards and tried to say that the single national constituency was not an essential part of Hare's scheme. And in fact, we can make some concessions on that front. And once we do, we'll see that personal representation, as Hare conceived it, is in a sense the best way to achieve in the electoral realm goals and values to which there was broad assent in other realms of Victorian life. So I do in the book discuss some of those figures who kind of tried to domesticate Hare's scheme a little bit and push for it afterwards. But anyway, yeah, I think broadly that's a way of thinking about his importance. And I think he's been a sadly neglected figure by historians and political theorists.
Well, that's a major contribution of your book. He's neglected no longer. So he's dealt with in great detail. And I wonder if we could talk about another figure that you talked about, their view of history, and one who was looking backwards rather than forwards was Walter Badgett. Could you discuss his ideas in comparison to Hare, and how and what was the variety of suffrages school, and did they call themselves that, or is that your own term? That's a term of art that's come to be applied to them, or?
Good question. Maybe this is a chance for me just to lay out a little bit the contending, by way of answering your question, to lay out a little bit some of the contending schools of thought in the book. So yeah, the book is basically the kind of leading argument of the book is that there is this overarching commitment that transcends kind of partisan or ideological boundaries to create a parliament that kind of accurately mirrors the different interests and social cleavages within the nation. And, you know, what I try to argue there is that once you appreciate the broad reach of this ideal, you can then see that there was a disagreement amongst kind of different interpretations of what this implied. And as you point out, Walter Badgett, who is, you know, has been called the greatest Victorian, and some people will know of him from, say, The Crown, for example. The Crown begins with with the young Elizabeth reading Walter Badgett to learn about her duty as a constitutional monarch and so on. Or maybe people know of his sort of economic writings. Anyway, he was also a writer on...
and he founded the Economist magazine too. People might know him for that. So
exactly, yeah. He was also a writer on parliamentary reform, and he is emblematic of, as you say, what I call the variety of suffragist school. And you asked if that was it. It's a term of art to apply it to the whole swath of thinkers, but the term is itself taken directly from their own writings. So, you know, Walter Badgett said that a variety of suffrages was the true liberal principle for regulating electoral matters. What they meant by that was this, basically, that in order to have a House of Commons that would adequately reflect different classes, interest groups, and ideological movements, you could not just accept a uniform suffrage, right? Instead, you had to deliberately vary the kinds of constituencies you created and the rules for qualifying for the vote within those constituencies across the nation. And you did this because that very diversity of electoral rules would then permit all the different facets of a diverse society to have spokesmen in parliament. And they believed, as you kind of alluded to in your question, they believed that their proposals for reform to increase the amount of variety in the electoral system and kind of tailor the rules of the electoral system in order to bring different interests into parliament, they believed that these proposals accorded with English constitutional history. Mm. Because until the 1832 Reform Act, the long inherited unreformed parliament was a sort of haphazard patchwork of different rules in different boroughs that had arisen for all kinds of reasons, because a kind of royal edict making the borough impose certain rules at the time, because different rules had developed over history in different ways, because in a certain borough, everyone who was a freeman of a corporation was able to qualify, or everyone who paid a certain tax was able to qualify. And then in other boroughs, there were quite high property qualifications and so on. And there was no standardization across a huge portion of the pre-1832 electoral system.
Huge cities were not were underrepresented versus tiny, little, fairly insignificant agricultural. That was one of the biggest beefs, right?
Exactly. So, yeah, huge. These kind of rising industrial cities like Manchester are absent from the scene, whereas towns that have four people, you know. So what people like Badgett do is they look back and say, of course we needed the Reform Act, because the system had come badly. It had all these corruptions within it, and it had come, in a sense, badly out of joint with developments within British society. You can't leave out major industrial and trading towns and yet have, in effect, entirely empty villages returning two members to Parliament. But they did believe the principle that underlay the tolerance of this sort of haphazard, unstandardized, very diverse patchwork of electoral laws was a good one, and that you could kind of revive that principle for a now modernizing England. So really there, you know, for them, they are bitter opponents of any kind of uniform suffrage. And you can think a little bit about how much this contrasts with our own instincts today. I mean, I think now people are quite horrified to think that requirements to vote in, let's just say, one county wildly differ from those the next county over. We would consider this arbitrary and exclusive and unfair. But in fact, that didn't trouble people like Badgett at all. They saw uniformity as really a dreadful aspect of an electoral system. And this is because if you have a uniform suffrage that has extremely, say, restrictive requirements for holding the vote, say you need to own a significant amount of property, well, then that amounts to oligarchy, as they would say. only the opinions of a kind of upper class would be included in the representative system. But conversely, if you have a uniform suffrage that has no requirement for the vote, or only, say, very permissive requirements for the vote, what we would call democracy, what they call democracy, well, then you open yourself up to what would be called the tyranny of the majority. The idea that the working class or other majority groups, like, say, Catholics in Ireland or something, by virtue of their vast numbers, would simply swamp or overwhelm the other elements in society and lead to a kind of monolithic and exclusivist parliament. And, you know, then they feared that all kinds of dreadful sort of ills would follow from either of these forms of exclusion, an oligarchic one or a democratic form of exclusion, including kind of partial and unenlightening parliamentary debate and instability, stagnation, a halting of progress, and so forth. So that's really the kind of variety of suffrages view, the idea that what you would do is deliberately vary suffrage rules and constituency construction across across the country. And I go through in the book a bunch of different models. These include rather Baroque templates. Sorry, there's extreme, a lot of noise right outside my window out of nowhere. I'm not sure what that is. I think a leaf blower or some street cleaner. Anyway, sorry if you can hear that. But anyway, these were like quite simple models sometimes. Bagehot's view was basically, let's have universal suffrage in the cities in order that the sort of urban working classes could get themselves represented there. But let's have more restrictive requirements in other parts of the country, such that different propertied interests can have a place in parliament. And others, as I said, had more Baroque schemes where they would really earmark certain constituencies just for different religious groups or just for different professional orders. And in effect, these variety of suffrages views could approximate extremely elaborate systems of quotas in order to make sure that kind of every single voice in this polyphonic society of theirs could have parliamentary spokesmen. So, you know, that's really where the book takes off, is by looking at these figures who thought of themselves as not Democrats because they rejected the uniformity of the suffrage, but who also saw themselves as being diverse and inclusive and as aspiring for diversity, inclusivity, deliberation across kind of different interests as the overarching goals of a parliamentary system. And then the book sort of looks at democratic responses to this. And I basically say that there are two, you know, there's kind of a democratic response that accepts these values of the variety of suffragists, values like diversity, inclusivity, deliberation, and suggests that in fact, a democratic suffrage regime is not going to prove inconsistent with them. In fact, it will enhance and preserve diversity and deliberation, say. So that's kind of a first response, an attempt to meet these variety of suffragist theorists on their own turf and show that democracy is consistent with their ideal. And secondly, I map out sort of Democrats who just decide to reject the variety of suffragist ideals altogether and attack those ideas as being kind of arbitrary, unfair, inconsistent with equality and impartiality and values like non-arbitrariness that they see as absolutely essential to representative government.
That would be the Ramsay MacDonald school that he just said, enough of these complex systems, they're just silly and they're just, they're not fair. And
indeed, yeah, I think he kind of comes out of he's sort of a bit of a later kind of at the tail end of what the book covers chronologically, but yeah, certainly. And you know, what the person I mentioned earlier, Albert Van Dicey, he kind of stands in as the figure who articulates this democratic objection to the variety of suffragist school in the earlier kind of part of the chronology in the mid-Victorian period where a lot of the book focuses. And then I talk about how the theory of proportional representation sort of comes out of, you know, enters as a sort of third school that also very strongly announces the need for Parliament to mirror the nation and all of its diverse interests, but proposes an extremely different technical means to do this, not by varying suffrage rules, but in fact by having uniform suffrage rules, but changing how votes are allocated. Also, though, then brings in a kind of different set of values and inflects some of the existing values about deliberation and diversity in a somewhat different light. And so those are sort of the three broad schools. And at each, you know, part of the book, I try to talk both about their own value system and how that related to the institutions they endorsed, but also try to deal with critics of them. So as you noted, you know, in discussing proportional representation, I also try to deal with figures who upheld what we would now call a first-past-the-post system, an idea of plurality rule, fixed territorial constituencies, against the views of the proportionalists. And try to stage these as debates that involve kind of moral disagreement about what ends to pursue, and also, though, kind of concrete disagreements about whether, in fact, specific institutions serve shared values, say. So, you know, you can reject the variety of suffrages on the grounds that that the means they adopt, the institutions they adopt, this system of varying the character of constituencies and suffrage rules across society is not a good means to achieve their own ends of diversity and inclusivity and so on. Or you could just reject those ends. Say those are not, in fact, the most important values to pursue. And one of the things the book shows, for example, is that there were kind of Democrats in each of those two camps. And similarly with proportional representation, there were people who rejected it because they just thought that it wasn't a good route to achieve extremely important values, which the proportionalists themselves upheld. And then there were people who kind of rejected the entire value system of the proportional representationists, and instead advocated quite different sets of kind of ends for an electoral system to pursue. So
is that one of the reasons that your book is valuable? Because the fact that proportional representation did not catch on, and you explain why, and that's very helpful to, because Britain to this day, in fact, they had a referendum in the 1990s about it, and it just died apparently, and even decades later. So it shows that the book is very relevant even now. So, but I'd like to ask about, you mentioned the word stagnation and the fact that many of them worried about stagnation in Parliament, how to keep it a lively intellectual forum. The question was, how do you get it that way, or how do you keep it that way without getting, the word swamped is also used, that they feared that just the personnel would be working people who were not well educated, and also the fact that they distrusted political parties. I'm realizing that throwing a lot at you, but could you discuss stagnation versus intellectual, vivacity or vigor, and how each of them address that?
Good question. And it seems like finally whatever this very loud noise was on the street has dissipated. So my apologies for being a bit.
Oh, it's okay. I don't think it'll come across. So.
Well, that's great. So I think stagnation was a major bugbear of sort of 19th century liberal, very broadly construed thought. And, you know, anyone who's read Mill can see these kinds of fears. Broadly, there's the idea that with the kind of arrival of a mass society, you know, there will be a deadening of intellectual life. This is something that one sees in Tocqueville as well. And especially the fear is something like, well, as the working classes come to a kind of political ascendancy, does that mean that politics will be subjected to the least intelligent, the least educated, so to speak, stratum of the nation, and that there will be a sort of a loss of new ideas, a loss of deliberation across these different contending classes in favor of just a sort of single and in their eyes, particularly benighted or backwards or ignorant point of view. And different people had different thoughts about this matter. So plenty of folks, some of them that I talk about here, just reject it. I mean, they find that to be a kind of prejudicial way of viewing the working class. They see the working class as just as capable of deliberation, just as able, just as kind of riven by moral differences as any other class in society. And they see that they view their introduction into that kind of into constitutional and political life with something like equanimity. And those people often are quite okay with instruments that we now all accept today, like the mass disciplined political party, as a way of allowing average citizens to exert some say in politics and of, you know, structuring deliberation in political life for a mass electorate. But as you point out, plenty of other people were deeply concerned about the prospect of stagnation and wanted to find ways to avoid it. And one of these ways was proportional representation. Again, and also the variety of suffrages appeals to this too. But there, both of these claim that they provide routes by which you'll avoid a working class monopoly of parliamentary life. So, and the hope is that by avoiding that, you will retain this kind of clash of interest against interest, value against value, that allows for progress to flourish. You can see here a kind of outlook that's best known perhaps from Mill's On Liberty. You can see that that concern about the necessity of diversity for the creation of truth was also present, not just in debates, particularly about freedom of speech, but also in debates about the character of the electoral system. And then though there were kind of opponents on each of these, you know, there were opponents to both the variety of suffrages and proportional representation who also feared stagnation, but just thought that the particular models that their antagonists were advocating would make the problem worse. So one of the arguments against Hare's system is that it will be kind of cliquish. Mm. Yes, it's true that Hare's system will allow a lot of, you know, it will allow a lot of eccentricity into Parliament, potentially. Yeah. But why they say would that be a good thing? I mean, why is it that we want, you know, if 1/658 of the country can just band together, you know, can their votes can simply accumulate on a single individual who will then go into Parliament and only kind of beat the drum for whatever strange or eccentric view that they alone care about. How is that in their mind fostering deliberation? For these folks, what's actually of value is the traditional local constituency, because the traditional local constituency gives you a sort of defined geographical community in which citizens can come to know one another and in which they can stage debates that are intelligible to them. So having to compete to win majorities within particular local constituencies, they think, is precisely what's required for having productive deliberation and for avoiding a kind of deadening of political life. So one thing you can see here is that this maybe maps on to a difference of thought about where the focal point of political deliberation should be. Should it be in Parliament itself? If it should be in Parliament itself, then what, you know, in a sense, all that matters is getting in all of the relevant voices, getting spokesmen for all of the relevant voices within the House of Commons and letting them duke it out over the course of the House's debates. But if what matters for avoiding stagnation is keeping citizens engaged, well, then you might want, you might look at electoral systems completely differently. And that's something that you kind of see in, you know, the way I try to reconstruct the debates between proportional representation theorists and their antagonists who favored traditional local constituencies.
Well, there were some really funny passages in the books making fun of the idea that under some of the schemes that a, say, a vegetarian who was obsessed with vegetarian and vegetarianism only, that he would get a seat in parliament, whereas a person who represented an entire coal mining community would not, and that kind of thing. But you lay out the consequences very, very well, and some of the arguments were ferocious and funny. They would just ridicule each other's arguments with great zeal and humor. You mentioned, well, we're getting towards the end, but I was just going to say you talked about the protectionist overtones of some of Mill's ideas. Could you talk? Well, you discussed that, the protectionist ideas, but who else represented the idea of keeping people out of Parliament? I mean, what were some of the specific techniques? One of the things I thought was fascinating in the book was that the working class spokespeople had to calm people down by saying, well, we're really not a threat. In fact, we'll be so mild and so insignificant and so milquetoasty that they had to undermine their own argument for representation in a way. And you make the point that the middle class was the bete noire of many of the people involved, that it wasn't so much the working class, it was the middle class that they thought was in danger of having too much power.
So I think I'm not sure that Mill was somebody who was accused of protectionist ideas. I think his side, people who supported Hare and the single transferable vote system, which, you know, they thought of themselves as in a way introducing laissez-faire principles and principles of free association and free trade into the electoral system. They accused their opponents of a kind of protectionism. But that doesn't mean that people like Mill and Hare were Democrats by our standards. Mm-hmm. And indeed, I think, you know, it's best. There's quite a lot of loose talk about how democratic Mill was, when in fact Mill favored pretty significant restrictions on the franchise, and, you know, favored things like public voting. He opposed the secret ballot, which, you know, are somewhat hard to stomach for contemporary Democrats. So one shouldn't, I think, you know, imagine that just because someone like Hare or Mill, you know, adopts values and views that now have a kind of democratic resonance to them, we can't assume that they themselves understood what they were doing as advancing the cause of democracy. Hare, I think, certainly didn't see himself as a Democrat in any strong sense. With Mill, it's a bit more ambiguous. Sometimes he did see himself as a sort of true Democrat, and sometimes he distinguished himself from the kind of broader cause of democracy and saw himself as offering an alternative to it. As for your other, you asked about fearing the working classes, the middle classes. I think, again, just to be a bit rapid here, there are widely varying estimates of kind of the value of what different classes have to contribute to the political process. And there are differing estimates of where, in fact, power seems to lie at any given time. After 1832, a number of people did become kind of worried that the middle classes, these are quite affluently, you know, the middle class quite affluently defined, that they had in fact come to arrogate a kind of monopoly on political life, and that this was deeply to be sort of deplored, and that a number of different voices, in particular voices from the working class, needed to be included in the process. Mill would certainly, I think, fall under that heading. But, you know, as you say, there was an incredible amount of fear about the working class. It's important to bear in mind when we look back on this that there was not anything even close to a national public education system in Britain until 1870. Mm. So in a way, you know, it's not irrational to fear what will happen when a huge swath of uneducated voters enters the political process. We might not like some of the conclusions they draw, but it was a, you know, quite a different time, and worth reflecting on why they might have been afraid of that outcome. And different arguments were made about how to think about including the working class in that context. So as you point out, some people said, well, look, the working class will actually be quite deferential to the classes above.
Yeah, deferential.
Therefore including them will have all kinds of broader moral benefits. It will increase the stability of the system too. It will make the working classes feel that they have a stake in politics. It will contribute to their political education. You know, in a sense, these people argue that the only way to become capable as a class of participation in political life is to start participating in it and learning, you know, learning on the job, so to speak. So that's kind of one argument, that this will not lead to a broad dislocation. It will not change fundamentally the character of English politics, but instead allow for a kind of gradual improvement. And but as you say, that's kind of a way of arguing for the working classes that diminishes what distinctive contribution they might bring, at least in the near term. It sort of suggests a longer term horizon whereby the working classes come to throw about their weight in, you know, in politics only after a sort of process of acculturation and education sets in.
I better let you go because you're on your way to a meeting, I know. So I will just, if that's all right, I will end it here because you're a busy man and I've taken up a lot of your time.
No problem.
Unless you want to make one more point.
Well, I'll just conclude by saying, you know, yeah, that way of sort of advocating for working class inclusion as not especially disruptive is not going to be satisfying to Democrats who advance universal suffrage precisely because they find the status quo intolerable, you know, and do wish for democracy to bring about a kind of dislocation and a radical change in political and social life. And so, again, you can see how even advocating something as radical at the time as a move towards universal suffrage can take on extremely different ideological valences. You know, it can be a tool for shoring up and conserving and gradually improving a system, or it can be a means to radically dislocating it. And you can see, yeah, very different views of democracy that stem from that disagreement, even within the camp of people who want to make a change in that direction. So anyway, yeah, I'll stop there.
Well, it really is a wonderful book because there's so many figures from Virginia Woolf's father, Leslie Stevens, he's discussed, and Dicey, who your next book is about, is a fascinating figure, and I look forward to that very much. And Badgett, for those people who want to know about this aspect of his career, which is multifaceted, and it's just a really rich, fascinating, useful book. You wouldn't think that it would have been for modern days, but it is. So thank you very much. And we'll just with that, we'll end, and thank you everyone. And thank you for listening. Bye-bye.